A senior Hamas leader is killed in a drone attack in Beirut.
Netanyahu pretty boldly, maybe 3 weeks ago, you know, said nobody's safe anywhere. We're coming after all the leaders of Hamas. So this is basically the manifestation of that.
New fears this might widen the war. 379 people escaped from a burning jetliner in Japan after it collided with another aircraft. And making fully 3D virtual reality videos for training and entertainment.
In this prototype, Morishano appears to be performing from a famous concert hall in Romania.
Today is Wednesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. A senior Hamas leader was killed on Tuesday night in an Israeli drone strike in a suburb of Beirut. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelina reports this neighborhood is a stronghold of the allied Lebanese militant group Hezbollah.
Salah al-Arouri was a member of Hamas's political bureau and a co-founder of its military wing. His killing marks the first assassination of a Hamas official outside Palestinian territories since the group's deadly assault on Israeli territory on October 7, and could signal the conflict between Hamas and Israel is expanding. In response to questions from Reuters, the Israeli military said it does not respond to reports in foreign media. Lebanon's national news agency said the drone struck a Hamas office. Two security sources said it had targeted a meeting and left several people dead, including Palestinians and Lebanese. Protests broke out in the West Bank following the attack. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati called the strike a new Israeli crime and said it was an attempt to pull Lebanon into war. His office said he asked Lebanon's foreign minister to file a complaint to the United Nations Security Council. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General called the strike extremely worrying.
Because of the escalating tensions and the fragility of the situation in the region, we are calling for maximum restraint from all parties. We don't want any rash actions that could trigger further violence.
Hezbollah has been exchanging near-daily fire with Israel across Lebanon's southern frontier since Hamas's attack in October. Israeli airstrikes and shelling have killed more than 100 Hezbollah fighters and nearly two dozen civilians since then.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino. In a handwritten statement, Hezbollah said the attack will not go without a response or punishment. It announced an attack on Israeli forces across the border, but did not specify whether it was in response to Arouri's killing. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Joining us now to talk about this is Daniel L. Davis, a senior fellow and military expert at Defense Priorities. Davis retired from the U.S. Army as a lieutenant colonel. After 21 years of active service, he was deployed into combat zones four times in his career, beginning with Operation Desert Storm in 1991 and then on to Iraq in 2009 and Afghanistan twice. So what was your first reaction when you first heard the news about the attack in Beirut?
I mean, part of me understands that Israel, because they've been openly signaling this, Netanyahu pretty boldly, maybe 3 weeks ago, you know, said nobody's safe anywhere. We're coming after all the leaders of Hamas. So this is basically the manifestation of that. But my second thought right after it is this going to help Israel out, or is this going to make the expansion of the war more likely? And I tend to think it's going to be the latter, because it's not going to help Israel out any, I don't think, either, certainly not tactically, but I doubt even operationally, because, you know, I've watched so many times during my tours in both Afghanistan and Iraq to where U.S. or the coalition took out, you know, any number of high-value targets. I mean, heck, you can go all the way to you know, Osama bin Laden, for example, Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Baghdadi from ISIS. Every time you take out a leader, somebody else replaces him. So this is part of their DNA. They understand, everybody understands when they get to a top level, if they can be taken out. And so there's always a plan. And very often, you've seen that the guy that follows an assassinated leader is even more violent, even more radical than the one he took out. So the end result may even be negative just on that surface alone. But, you know, right now the situation is so volatile in Lebanon specifically, you know, that they now then, you know, they're going to retaliate in some way. I can't even imagine that they would allow this assassination in Beirut, in the capital city, and do nothing, especially after Nasrallah had publicly announced earlier this summer that any assassination, you know, in Lebanon would be responded. So there's, in my view, zero chance that he'll back down from that. Now, he would probably not stay in power if he did or if he didn't. So what's he going to do? You know, is he going to strike somewhere deeper inside Israel? Is he going to hit, you know, some senior Israeli official? You know, that just now then they'll have to respond. And so you see the escalation ladder could go up quick. And then the next thing you know, Hezbollah could be, you know, in the war openly. I mean, I know that, I guess I've been watching some of the regional media this afternoon, and I know that a lot of the people in Lebanon are afraid of exactly that. They think that this is just going to be the spark that leads to an expansion of the war, that their country is going to be, you know, part of the future battlefield, and that's a very real possibility.
Do you think that that's something that both sides really want and won't say, or do you think that they just stumbled into this?
Israel doesn't stumble into anything. They are very calculated in everything that they do because they're in the position where they can just do what they want. They don't have to respond to things particularly. You know, certainly not tactically. They're not obligated to do anything. They're calling all their own shots. There has definitely been a segment of the Israeli side from the outset that has said that, in fact, there was a lot of reports that in the first week or so of the war that there was a significant group within the war cabinet that was advocating that Netanyahu just on his own open up a northern front to take out Hezbollah. Now I know that you know, long term I've heard many Israeli commentators and opinion leaders that have said, hey, as soon as we get finished with Hamas, we're going to Hezbollah because we can't leave that threat on our northern border. If we take care of the one in the Gaza Strip, we got to take that one out too, otherwise we'll never be safe and all that. So I know that mentality is certainly on the ground there. And so it's definitely not out of reach or unreasonable to suggest that Israel wants to prompt that, so then they'll have the casus belli to, okay, well, now we have to go in because whatever Hamas does or Hezbollah does in response, you know, they say, oh, now we have to retaliate and whatever. So everything depends on what happens next, but certainly that's a real risk.
Daniel L. Davis with Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank. This is cell phone video on board a Japanese jetliner on fire on the runway in Japan. The jet and a Japanese Coast Guard aircraft collided, and both planes burst into flames. Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones reports everyone on the jetliner, 379 people, got off the plane and survived.
Eyewitness footage captured passengers running across the tarmac after leaving the Airbus A350 aircraft on an evacuation slide, having landed from the northern island of Hokkaido. Five of the six crew in the other smaller aircraft died, according to Japan's transport minister.
Japan Airlines informed Japan Civil Aviation Bureau that 379 people, including 367 passengers and 12 crew members, had been safely evacuated. Regarding the Coast Guard plane, one captain was evacuated, but five other crew members were confirmed dead.
The Japan Airlines plane was overwhelmed by the blaze despite efforts by rescue crews to control it. Broadcaster NHK, citing the Tokyo Fire Department, said at least 17 people on board were injured. The Coast Guard said the collision involved one of its planes headed to Niigata Airport on Japan's west coast to deliver aid following the powerful earthquake which struck on New Year's Day, killing tens of people. Japan Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's office said he had called for a swift assessment of the damage. A Haneda Airport spokesperson confirmed all runways were closed and flights were cancelled following the incident.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. As for the earthquake that the Coast Guard jet was flying relief supplies to, the death toll continues to rise, and officials say the damage is so great it could not be immediately assessed. Aftershocks continued to shake the area, and Japanese media reports say tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed. It was another day of heavy Russian missile and drone strikes on Kyiv and Kharkiv. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan with the latest on Ukraine.
Russia fired scores of deadly missiles and drones at Kyiv and Kharkiv in Ukraine on Tuesday. The attacks struck residential buildings and civilian infrastructures. In a suburb of the capital city, resident Inna Lukashenko said the strikes were relentless.
We were under fire the whole night. First, there were drones, then we fell asleep for a second and were woken up by explosions. Hearing that missiles are in the air, me and my child hid in the corridor. We were very scared.
In Kharkiv, emergency workers said they were working in four locations across the city and that most injuries were caused by shrapnel. The attacks came hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin said an air attack on the Russian city of Belgorod would not go unpunished. Moscow said the strike on Saturday killed at least 25 civilians and blamed it on Ukraine. There was no official comment from Kyiv in the hours after the attack on Belgorod. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said gas pipelines had been damaged in parts of the capital in Tuesday's assault, and electricity and water had been cut off in several districts, bringing back memories of last winter when Russia pounded the energy grid with missiles, causing frequent power outages and plunging millions into darkness. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said at least 70 Russian missiles were shot down on Tuesday.
I thank everyone in the world who helps. Patriots, IRIS, NASAMS, every such system has at least saved hundreds of lives. Russia will answer for every life taken away. Glory to Ukraine.
A Ukraine Air Force spokesperson said after the initial barrage, the situation remained tense and that air defenses were bracing for more Russian missile launches. And Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba called on Western allies to accelerate supplies of air defense systems, long-range missiles and combat drones. Russia has stepped up airstrikes on Ukraine over the New Year period. On Friday, it conducted the largest air attack since the start of the war.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. We're following these other stories from around the world. Sierra Leone authorities have charged 12 people with treason in connection with a failed coup in November, including a member of former President Ernest Bai Koroma's security detail. Gunmen attacked in that coup attempt a military barracks, a prison, and other locations. Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces group said on Tuesday it was open to an immediate, unconditional ceasefire through talks with the Sudanese army. A nine-month war in Sudan, which now faces the world's largest displacement crisis, has devastated the country's infrastructure and prompted warnings of famine. Harvard University President Claudine Gay resigned Tuesday amid plagiarism accusations and criticism over testimony at a congressional hearing where she was unable to say unequivocally that calls on campus for the genocide of Jews would violate the school's conduct policy. Gay is the second Ivy League president to resign in the past month following that congressional testimony. Liz McGill, president of the University of Pennsylvania, resigned on December 9th. Somalia lashed out at a pact signed between its breakaway region, Somaliland, and Ethiopia. While the agreement would have allowed landlocked Ethiopia to use the Red Sea port of Berbera, Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo reports Somalia's position is the agreement has no legal force.
Government spokesman Fahan Mohamed Jimali.
Ethiopia's step is an offensive that endangers the stability and peace of the region, which was already wobbling with problems. It is a violation and an open invasion of Somalia's sovereignty, freedom, and unity of the Federal Republic of Somalia. The so-called Memorandum of Understanding and Agreement of Cooperation is null and void.
The agreement would permit landlocked Ethiopia, which relies on neighboring Djibouti for most of its maritime trade, to set up commercial operations at a leased military base in Berbera. Ethiopia's national security advisor confirmed on Monday that it would offer Somaliland a stake in its state-owned airline in return. The agreement also included recognizing Somaliland as an independent nation in due course. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's stated ambition to secure access to the Red Sea is a source of tension with its East African neighbors, and that's raising concerns about a fresh conflict in the Horn of Africa. The Ethiopian government did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Despite declaring autonomy from Somalia in 1991, Somaliland has not gained international recognition. Somalia says Somaliland is part of its territory. Last week, the Somali National News Agency said the two parties had agreed to restart talks following mediation efforts led by Djibouti.
Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Malawi's government is sending young people to work on Israeli farms. Palestinians who used to do the work are not allowed to because of the war with Hamas. Critics say the program is shrouded in secrecy and has exposed unemployment issues in Malawi. Human rights activists argue that the young people are willing to take opportunities abroad despite the risks. Chimwemwe Pidata reports from the capital, Lilongwe.
Young people line up in large numbers at registration centers like this one for recruitment and a program that gives Malawians opportunities to work on farms in Israel. They are hoping to join about 600 Malawians who have been airlifted to Israel through the agricultural program. A resident of Blantyre, the country's second largest city, 23-year-old Ruth Kanchunjuru, is ready for such an opportunity.
It's a lifetime opportunity. I wouldn't lose it because at some part of the country there is war.
As Israeli reservists have been called up for military service since the war with Hamas began in October, Malawi is not the only country Israel has been making labor exchange deals with to fill gaps created on farms. Kenya announced that it was sending 1,500 farm workers in December, and Israeli officials said recruitment is underway in Uganda and Tanzania. But the labor exchange program in Malawi isn't without critics. Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, accuses the government of secrecy on the deal. Maiko Kayata, the vice chairperson for the rights group, says they want access to information on Israel's treatment of foreign workers.
That's why it's important that details, like issues of safety, issues of pay.
Malawi's labor ministry says it plans to send at least 5,000 people to work in Israel's farms, but the figure could go as high as 15,000. Israeli ambassador Michael Lotem recently told a local publication that the labor export will benefit the two countries. But as of December 2023, a memorandum of understanding is yet to be signed. According to Malawi government spokesperson Moses Kunkuyu,
I mean, the MOU that we have to also be a guide document in as far as the operations of the agents on the ground are concerned. And young people get employment, that process.
Through the labor exchange program, Malawi's government says it anticipates generating foreign exchange as young people get jobs abroad. Chimwemwe Pidata, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
And finally, using holographic cameras to capture people's movements in three dimensions to make 3D virtual reality videos for training, education, and entertainment. Technology with the power to transform how we learn and entertain ourselves. VOA's Julie Tabo visits the University of Maryland in the United States, where it's being developed.
Concert violinist Irina Morishano may be playing for a non-existent audience, but not for long. In the specially outfitted holocamera studio at the University of Maryland, hundreds of 3D cameras are capturing her image and movements to create a lifelike hologram. Her holographic twin can then be placed virtually into any setting so that someone with a virtual reality headset can feel like they're watching her live. In this prototype, Morishano, who is also an associate professor of violin at the university, appears to be performing from a famous concert hall in Romania.
My wish was for me, or for my hologram, I should say, to be put on the stage of the Romanian Athenaeum. We hired a team to film the Athenaeum so that when someone would watch this recording of the Romanian piece, they would see me on the stage of the Athenaeum.
Amitabh Varshney is dean of the university's College of Computer, Mathematical, and Natural Sciences.
Virtual and augmented reality experiences help us recreate the world in a much more precise, accurate way than we would ever with just a desktop monitor with a keyboard and a mouse.
Using advanced holographic imagery to allow viewers to virtually walk around the action has applications well beyond music and education. The holocamera team is developing a prototype for performing arts that it hopes can be expanded into remotely training healthcare professionals in intricate medical procedures, including surgeries. Julie Tabo, VOA News, College Park, Maryland.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As we head into 2024, we will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with those who share our vision for a free, open, prosperous, and secure world, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a year-end press conference. First, we will continue to rally countries around the world to support Ukraine's freedom and independence, and to ensure that Russia's aggression remains a strategic failure, said Secretary Blinken.
Russia is weaker militarily, economically, diplomatically. NATO is bigger and stronger and more united than at any point in its nearly 75-year history. This year, we added our 31st member of NATO, Finland, and Sweden will join soon, bringing even greater potency and capability to our defensive alliance.
Another priority for 2024 will be to continue to engage with China from a position of strength, said Secretary Blinken.
We're deepening cooperation and coordination between NATO and our Indo-Pacific allies. These efforts have allowed us to engage more effectively when tackling areas of concern, like China's course of trade and economic practices, peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and the East and South China Seas, and human rights.
Third, the United States is committed to working with others for the good of our people and for people around the world, said Secretary Blinken.
That's exactly what we did in 2023, rallying coalitions of governments, businesses, civil society, regional and multilateral institutions to tackle food insecurity, to promote secure, safe, trustworthy AI systems, to fight the synthetic drug crisis, to stop the scourge of governments that arbitrarily detain foreign nationals for leverage, to mobilize hundreds of billions of dollars to build physical, digital, clean energy and health infrastructure across developing countries.
With regard to the conflict between Israel and Hamas, Secretary Blinken said the U.S. will focus on helping Israel ensure that what happened on October 7th can never happen again, bringing the conflict to an end as quickly as possible while minimizing the loss of life and the suffering of civilians, getting the remaining hostages back home to their families, preventing the conflict from spreading, and once and for all breaking the devastating cycle of violence and moving toward durable, lasting peace. The United States looks forward to strengthening its network of alliances and partnerships to meet the challenges of 2024.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.